Hey, Anna, are you interested in some gorgeous property on another planet? Would you be interested in some land on Mars?
Oh, heck, I mean, can I get like a view or something?
Have I Maybe. Got a deal for you?
Are you a real estate agent now?
I got some choice property on the red planet I'm willing to part with for a very reasonable sum of money.
Really?
Would you be interested? You'd be interested in some property on Mars?
I mean, we could talk about it. This seems totally legit.
Oh, good. Well, you're the exact kind of person I want to talk to about this, because this is the thing that's been going around, that this company has kind of advertised property on Mars, that it's selling Mars. And so people were asking, well, is this for real or is this not for real? You sound like you're on board. You're ready to sign today. Like, what do I have to do to put you on a property on Mars?
Put you on this beautiful plot in the red play on the red planet. I mean, I'm interested. I never thought of myself as gullible, but maybe.
Well, I mean, there are some problems as to like who owns Mars, number one. And
I'm about to. It sounds like.
Well, yeah. That's a good point. So the company that's doing this is as you, well, I guess maybe not as you imagined, is not legitimate. This is not the actual thing that they can actually sell property on Mars. And there's a nice little disclaimer at the bottom that says for entertainment purposes only. So if you were to purchase this, you would get a nice little certificate and that kind of thing to say what part of Mars that they are selling you. But if you'd ever get to Mars, it wouldn't be yours. I'm sorry to say.
You couldn't evict some Martians. You'd
have to know. So Mars is not for sale. So I'm sorry. You can't buy a piece of Mars that you could actually settle someday.
Darn it.
However, I do have some very choice property at the Sea of Tranquility that just came open you might be interested in.
Dean, come on.
From our mobile studios and Cincinnati Public Radio, I'm Dean Regas, and this is Looking Up.
I'm Anna Heeman, and we are both in the Cincinnati Observatory. For this recording, we are connected by Zoom and looking forward to talking with planetary scientist Tanya Harrison. All right, so you had are back studying real estate, intergalactic real estate. You are back from a big trip you took.
Yeah, it was one of those things where I'd been planning this for a long time. I wanted to tour the observatories of the Midwest and the Rocky Mountains, especially historic observatories. I know people can dream big, can't they? I can dream things like this. And so I had a tour set up. Like, I was going to visit these observatories, give talks, lectures, that kind of stuff, and to the public. In my mind, I was picturing it like a band world tour, but in reality, it was me by myself at a historic observatory.
In my Prius,
that's right, driving there with selling my mixtapes out of the back of the van or something like that. So I had this all set up. I had the tour dates set up, and I was going to visit these observatories and give talks. And the tour was going to start in mid-April. And as you might imagine, that wasn't going to work out. So one by one, we had to cancel all those, and then said, well, let's do it in June. Surely by June, things will be back to normal.
Surely by June.
Surely. And then that didn't happen. And so finally, cabin fever got the best of me. And I said, I don't have to give talks to these, adoring fans that I'm sure are going to pop out of nowhere to buy my mixtapes from the back of my car. Instead, why don't I just go to these observatories and, visit with the astronomers there and share some tales from the Cincinnati Observatory and see what these other places are like. And I had no idea if they were actually going to be able to do it. Like, I thought, well, I mean, they're probably closed. They probably won't be open to the public. But when you talk to astronomers, they're very, it's amazing. The community is really generous. I mean, they're just really open and giving, and who knows if they even knew who I was, but I just asked about the observatory. Can I come tour? And they said, sure. And so I got to visit 6 observatories on this little road trip, and trying to keep as socially distant and safe from everybody and masked up and everything, that not touch the telescope and all that kind of stuff. But so I started from Cincinnati, went up to the University of Illinois. They have an observatory there right on campus at in Champaign, Urbana, and got the tour of their telescope there, and then went up to Wisconsin to the Big Yerkes Observatory, which is outside on Williams Bay, Wisconsin. That's the one with the biggest refracting telescope in the world, 40 inches in diameter.
Oh, my Lord.
It was so cool to see. I'd been there before, but it's now under new ownership. So the University of Chicago owned it, and they sold it to a private group that's going to turn it into kind of a tourist attraction and a museum and a working observatory all in one. So it was really cool to see the progress they're making on that.
That's great.
And that scope there is impressive. I mean, it is humongous, number one. And they have this feature where there's not really viewing platforms. They raise the whole floor up to the telescope. So if you aim the telescope more horizontal, they raise the whole floor up to it.
How does that even, I mean, that's, wow.
Engineering.
That's not as old as we are?
It's not as old as our scope, but it's 1890s was when it went into service. And so they said something like that's possibly the biggest moving floor in the world, the way that just you push this button and it raises up. It was so cool. And the architecture, for folks that, if you want to look up Yerkes Observatory, just the way that they set it up, it's really cool, the architecture on it. It's very unique. So I got a tour of that, and then I went to Madison, Wisconsin, University of Wisconsin. They have an observatory there called the Washburn Observatory, right on the campus, looking over the lake. It was really a nice night to be able to see that. And so after that, I went to Iowa, in Des Moines, Iowa. There's a little observatory there from the 1890s, maybe even a little earlier, that's in a golf course. It's owned by the city and the university, and they give star parties there. And it was pretty amazing that this little place, they said, oh, you know, on a normal night, we have 100 people here. Well, I mean, before COVID, that is. And so it was cool to see all these places that are doing these events. And so then after that, I went to Nebraska to a little observatory called Boswell that's on Doan University's campus. And the final stop was in Denver at the Chamberlain Observatory. And the Chamberlain Observatory is very similar to our big scope, at the observatory here in Cincinnati.
They've been out to visit us before, haven't they?
Yeah, because we have a lot of connections with folks out in Denver. And their scope is just like ours, except a smidgen bigger. And their dome is just like ours, except a smidgen bigger also. And so it was really cool to meet all these astronomers and people, educators that are doing, you know, outreach education like we do. And they're still trying to navigate how we get through all this stuff. And I mean, out of all of them, it's kind of interesting that, you know, that we're the only ones that are actually open. The Cincinnati Observatories, all these other places, they're closed to the public, still trying to figure out how they can share these views.
Which, no wonder they were so excited to see you. They're like, come on in. Like, that would be great. We'd love to have you. We're twitching.
It is possible that I was the first person in some of those domes for months. It is certainly possible. And so I hope I'm not getting anybody in any trouble that they let me in to look at the I mean, I don't think anybody was like sneaking me in, but they were.
You were being safe, though.
They were. Oh, exactly. I mean, I didn't touch anything, and I had my mask on and everything like that, and I took pictures, and so it was. Yeah, it was really fun. I think they were looking. That was the thing, is they really miss it, and that's they miss the interactions with the people and sharing views through the telescopes. And but it was really cool to see that there's so many scopes out there of that age. You know, 1890s, 1880s vintage, and that once everything gets back to normal, that they're going to be using those scopes again. It's pretty exciting.
Well, definitely. I just still can't believe that you drove all the all of that you just said, and all I could think of is that is so much time in the car. Just kidding. I think it's great, though.
It was a long... I mean, our country is humongous. Like, I've driven cross-country several times, but it's been a while. And I think the only thing that, you know, that made it easier was the 7 months prior to this.
You're so happy to be out.
Being stuck in this house, like, oh, I can, you know, I'm good at sitting in front of screens. I'll just sit in front of the windshield for a couple hours. I mean, I could do that. That's nothing.
That's easy.
You think you can bore me? You can't bore me.
I've been in a pandemic at my house.
I've survived worse than this.
But you have that raccoon that's been visiting your house, or was visiting your house. That was some entertainment. But I haven't heard about him in a while, so maybe you're ready to get out.
Moving on to other creatures. I mean, we had the snake in the basement. We have the mice always coming through. It's a...
Actually, we have a mouse at my house. No, I was going to tell you about it, but I heard it last night. We're getting off track, but I heard it last... I said, do you hear that? And he's like, hear what? And I was like, that's a very distinctive squeak of a mouse. But it's starting to get colder, so...
You know what you need? You need a snake. That's what you need, a snake in the basement.
I'm not going to take your snake. We're not doing any kind of wildlife exchange, Dean. I'm not like, at best, I'll get one of your cats and come here and clean. Well, yours aren't good at catching mice, though.
No, they're not. The snake's much better.
Yeah, well, okay. Well, I'll think about it, because it's really, this mouse is bugging me. Anyway, it does sound like a great trip.
I have a snake story, actually. For folks that didn't, you know, there was a couple episodes before I talked about the snake that I have in the basement, that the skin was, I saw the skin was hanging from the rafters in the basement. So I have a 6 foot long snake in the house somewhere. my mom texted me after she heard the episode.
Oh, my God.
And she said, do you really have a snake in the house that's 6 feet long? And she said, or was this your like podcast exaggeration story?
To make your life more interesting, I guess.
That's right, exactly. That's right.
Is that what?
And I was like, no. I was like, yeah, Mom, it's true. Sometimes Anna exaggerates, but I.
Me? Please. Never.
No, it's true. It was 6 feet long, and we might have to post the picture. I don't know. It might scare
you. You have to post it. Especially because it's Halloween time. I know we're going to put this out later. Sorry, Kevin. I'm saying sorry to our producer, but it's Halloween time. You got to put the picture out and scare the bejeebus out of people, because you got a lot of things going for you here. You got a basement. And don't you have like a crawl space basement?
Because your house is a million years old. Yeah.
And then you've got the snake skin. And then you've got, like, that's even better than a snake, because it's like, where is the snake?
Right. That's the mystery.
This is incredibly scary, and I am here for it. I would like to see him make it around the
snake. Yeah, in my 130-year-old house, yeah, that's just what I need.
Can they climb vertically?
Oh, yeah, they can climb.
Are you serious?
Yeah, it could be anywhere. It could be anywhere in the house. I mean, so, anyway.
Anyway, Dean visited 6 historical observatories. Also, I just wanted to ask real quick, did you think about, like, naming this trip like your observatory?
Ooh, that's good.
T-O-U-R.
My observator.
We get you a sponsor, you know, Shell or Speedway or something. I don't even know. Somebody.
Yeah, somebody. Yeah,
I feel like we missed opportunity there, bud.
Well, the good news is that, when I got back, I was really excited to get back because it was a long drive back. But within 2 days, I was ready to hit the road again.
Are you serious?
I already got the cabin fever back again. So
how is this possible?
Maybe I'll just have to do another observator.
Observatory. You didn't even stretch your legs yet. Also, I'm trying to focus on what you're saying, but all I'm looking is in the background because I can see Dean at home, and I'm waiting to see if a snake just comes up to like pop in at the podcast and be like, hey, everybody, sorry to burst in here. Anyway. I'm sorry, I'm focusing. But
yeah, I know. I'm sure the snake could replace me on the podcast just like that. It would be nothing. It'd be
join you, maybe.
Gone. That's right. Yeah. So, but yeah, but people, if you don't hear from me in every 2 weeks on the podcast, the snake probably got me. But I'll keep checking in with everybody. And but yeah, I think you're right. Another observator should be in order, I think.
There you go.
Tanya Harrison is a planetary scientist known on Instagram as Tanya of Mars. Her company, Professional Martian, works to get information about space to a wider audience. She's used her geology background to analyze photos of space and was a science team collaborator on the Mars Rover project. Tanya Harrison, thanks for joining us on Looking Up.
Thanks so much for having me.
So as a big fan of Mars, we've been talking about how people are selling property on Mars. Could you sell us a choice piece of property on Mars? Where would be the best place for us to settle?
Oh, depends on if you want to be warm or if you want to have access to water, because these two things are mutually exclusive.
Well, we can't have warm and water.
No. So all the water on Mars tends to be locked up in ice in the higher latitudes. Like think the Martian equivalent of Canada northward. But if you want to be warm, you want to be at the equator. So that's where we tend to send things like Curiosity and Opportunity. A lot of the rovers are near the equator. But if we want to be able to mine ice for astronauts to drink, you'd have to be a little bit farther north in some less hospitable places like Utopia Planitia or Flagramontes, places like that.
Ooh, boy. Well, you didn't really sell us on that property. I don't know if you're this real estate agent. You're not as good as the people that are selling Mars land. But I don't know. I guess I would take the cold and water. I don't know.
Anna, stay alive longer that way.
Yeah. What would you say? Cold and water or hot and no water?
Well, is this a real question? Because I'm obviously going to go cold and water. I don't mind being cold and I like water. So.
All right,
something,
sold.
You know, yeah,
all right,
that's great.
We'll take it. We'll take that part.
Yes.
We'll take that land.
Sold. Tanya, you're a geologist, is that right? Your background is in geology. So how does that kind of play into your study of astronomy and planets and Mars in particular, maybe? Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. So when it comes to studying rocky planets like Mars, the moon, I guess, is not technically a planet, but we consider it kind of a planet in this case, Venus, Mercury. In order to understand what's happening, you have to understand geology on Earth first. So we take what we know here and then we apply it to other places. So, for example, we know what a volcano looks like on Earth. So if we see a volcano on Mars, it makes it easy to identify. If you get to some more exotic places in the solar system, like weird icy moons or the gas giants, obviously this breaks down a little bit. But having that foundation in geology on Earth is really critical before you start looking elsewhere in the universe.
Well, so tell us what it's like working on a Mars mission. I think, you know, we see these videos when the Mars rovers land and everybody's all cheering and celebrating. It looks like the most exciting place in the universe. Is it? What's it like working on a Mars mission?
It's pretty surreal. I did it for years, and I don't think it ever lost the novelty on a day-to-day basis. You don't necessarily know what you're going to see because you're getting pictures back every day. And maybe to most people, it just looks like, oh, here's more red rocks. But for somebody that studies Mars, you're like, this next rock just around the corner could be the one that unlocks all the mysteries that we've been wanting to answer in terms of what was Mars like in the ancient past and did it host life at some point. It's not always like you see in the movies where we're jumping around excited when the rovers land. Most of the time, it's actually people sitting at a computer coding in, like, using Linux or something like that to write up commands to control different things on the rover. So it's, if you were watching that, like, on a day-to-day basis, it's probably not super exciting. But since we all know what we're doing, I think that keeps everybody really excited.
So tell us about a professional Martian.
That just sort of came about from, I started getting requests through social media to do things like consulting for different science or sci-fi projects and speaking requests and stuff like that. And I decided to turn into a bigger thing when I was living in Phoenix and I started getting really integrated with the art community there through a bunch of my friends. And I was really inspired by how many of these artists were really excited about space, and they would ask such great questions about SpaceX and humans going to Mars and what the rovers were doing and how they worked. And I realized that we have a lot of outreach that's tailored to kids, and we have a lot of outreach kind of tailored to the echo chamber, you know, things that happen at science museums, podcasts that, like, people that are already interested in space would listen to. And I wanted to figure out how to create things that would engage folks that are not traditionally engaged with when it comes to STEM, specifically like teenagers and adults who might not know that this is something that is for them or might not know that they could get excited about it. And so I've been trying to find ways to create products and experiences and talks and events that can focus on different communities like that. Little hampered right now with COVID, but excited for when the world reopens someday to try and start doing more things again. Like the first thing we did was a friend of mine owned a bar in Phoenix called Sidebar. And the last time, so right now Mars is actually at what we call conjunction. So it's super bright, sorry, opposition. So it's super close to us right now. And so it's super bright in the sky. If you go outside, it's bright red. You can't miss it. The last time this happened, a couple years ago, we decided to turn Sidebar into Mars Bar, and we just decorated the whole place with aliens and had Mars-themed cocktails and Mars bars and stuff all around. And so people that just happened to be coming to the bar started asking questions. We would take them outside, show them Mars, and they would ask questions about space, and it was really cool. So these people that didn't expect to get a taste of science in their evening going out for happy hour suddenly got to learn all about space.
Oh, that is so cool. And I mean, I think that's a real good way of doing it, especially because, you know, Mars is so noticeable. It's like the greatest advertisement that people can see this out there. And, you know, it kind of made me think a little bit about, you know, the science fiction, too. I mean, because a lot of this stuff sounds, real science sounds very science fiction-y in a lot of ways. But do you find that there's like ways that you can use sci-fi to kind of help real science and especially even science education?
Definitely, especially if it's something a lot of people have seen. It gives you a reference. It was really helpful that The Martian was a super popular movie because you could say things like, I give a talk every once in a while about weather on Mars. And ever since that movie, I say, you're probably familiar with giant dust storms on Mars, but they're not actually anything like what you see in The Martian. So it gives people a point of reference. It also leads people to ask specific questions, because as soon as they find out you study space, folks always ask, you know, oh, have you seen Interstellar? Have you seen Gravity? What did you think of The Martian? Things like that. So I like that it creates this conduit for people to start asking questions. And then from there, they can move beyond the movie to things that they are curious about and had maybe not thought about before they watched something like that.
Definitely. So you mentioned that you're not doing a whole lot because of the pandemic, of course, but is there any projects you've been working on or things that you've been able to do or that you have been kind of have going on during the pandemic or that you have coming up?
Most of the stuff during the pandemic has been engagement with schools or through schools or groups like Girls Who Code. So talking to sort of middle school and up about ways that they can get involved in space, different career path opportunities, what types of programming languages they should learn, what it's been like being a woman in a particularly male-dominated field. Mm-hmm. And so that's been cool. It's a new opportunity compared to the limited reach that you might have just going to schools in your area, getting to talk to schools all around the world. I've spoken to schools in Australia, schools in Colombia, Mexico, Canada, the United States. So it's been really cool to get this opportunity to talk to so many different students about it.
That's awesome.
Well, that's great. Thanks. I really appreciate you taking the time here to talk about Mars and all the projects you are working on. It's been a lot of fun. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Tanya Harrison, also known as Tanya of Mars, and we're so glad she could join us today on Looking Up.
All right. Well, the pandemic has continued. And so, of course, I'm watching a lot of social media, seeing a lot of news, a lot of fact or fiction. We're going to do a fact or fiction right now with Dean, if you're ready.
I'm ready.
All right. So, fact or fiction, you can see, it's a double fact or fiction. So, ready?
Ready.
First part, can you see Mars with the naked eye? That's the easy one.
Very true. Yes, absolutely. Fact that Mars is bright and easy to see with the naked eye right now. If you face to the southeast after dark, it will be the biggest, brightest looking star in that part of the sky.
And it's tinted orange.
Very on brand. You cannot miss Mars up in the sky right now. That's for sure. No telescope needed.
I love that. And also, here's the follow-up, which is where we're getting, maybe we're in fiction territory. Can it ever be as big as the full moon? Will I ever look up and I see two giant eyes staring at me? One is Mars, one is the moon. Go.
That is pure fiction. That's one of those... That's one of those internet hoaxes that went around. It goes around every year or so about, oh, tonight only the Mars will be as big as the full moon. look for two moons in the sky. Yep, total fiction. Mars is so far away from us. Even when it's at its closest point, it's still 35, 40 million miles away. And the moon is only 240,000 miles away. So no way Mars will ever be as big as a full moon. If you ever see that on an email or social media, don't believe that one. That one's definitely
or
fiction.
Email Dean and ask him at dean@sinciobservatory.com.
Yeah, you could you could email me directly, and I have the standard.
And he'll just write back and no.
I have a little button that just says fiction.
This is a hoax.
That's right.
Well, and then there's other stuff up in the sky, like they got we got Jupiter and stuff. Which one's the brightest?
Aha, that is a really good kid question, or good question, because Mars and Jupiter, generally speaking, Jupiter is brighter than Mars. There's only some rare occasions where Mars can be outshine Jupiter just a little bit. And we had that earlier in the year. So in October, Mars was a smidgen brighter than Jupiter. And I kind of put that on social media to see if people can tell the difference. And most of them got it right. The Mars was just a little bit brighter than Jupiter. But now that we're heading towards winter, Mars is farther away from us. And now Jupiter is still has regained its crown as king of the nighttime planets.
Okay. Thank you so much for clearing up this edition of Fact or Fiction. Planetary edition, sort of.
Yep, we had fact, fiction, and fact.
It was a fiction sandwich. Fact sandwich.
Just the way I like it.
Well, that's it for this episode of Looking Up. Special thanks to Tanya Harrison, aka Tanya of Mars, for joining us. You'll find a link to her website on ours, wvxu.org/lookingup. And of course, while you're there, take a listen to some of our past episodes.
We really enjoy talking with interesting people like Tanya Harrison. Do you have any guest ideas for us? We'd love to hear from you. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, or drop us a note at lookingup@wvxu.org.
You can subscribe to Looking Up wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're an Apple Podcast user, we'd really appreciate a rating and comment. That helps others find us. Our theme song and additional music is by Y, that's W-H-Y question mark, from their album Moline, courtesy of Joyful Noise Recordings and Terror Bird Media.
Looking Up is a production of Cincinnati Public Radio. Kevin Reynolds is our producer, Josh Elstro is our engineer, and Jim Nolan provides additional technical assistance.
Thanks so much for listening. I'm Anna Heeman.
And I'm Dean Regas. Keep looking up.